Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
The next installment of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. A very good... for some reason, I can't remember going from part one to part two, but we're on to part three, the Sun and Earth, and the various mythological backgrounds of the Sun, and the modern discovery of the Sun with the telescopes and the like. And it's sort of very interesting to see the sort of interplay of different people. Galileo, who still was very much an Aristotelian, so believed in circles, hated Kepler and stuff like that. The soft porn Bible of Usher is pretty amazing, that story. Some of the publishing stories that he drags out are quite interesting, who ordered what article and stuff like that. Things which are lost, but sort of very subtle things like Einstein ordering 1,000 copies of the paper describing Hiroshima and stuff. We don't know whether this is true, but various things which are published but lost and then found later on. There's several incidences of this, like the Arabic stuff, also the Arabic information Islam about how they there is the black stone which is in the cube of Mecca, and the black stone being either possibly obsidian or a meteorite. Pretty interesting. Okay, so we're into part three, The Sun on Earth. In the 1950s, English author Stephen Porter made fun of the new craze for sunbathing in his best-selling book, Lifemanship, laying out three possibilities of how to tan. And he said beetroot, rich honey bronze, beetroot, and slug. Yeah, I don't quite understand that. Now, Sunspots by William Armory from 1874. The sunspots are really interesting in terms of that theologically, when the sun, to be a deity, couldn't have spots, so sunspots are a really important thing to cover. I've got this fly irritating me, so far. But some have thought that they were great masses of scoria, or cinders, or dross floating on a sea of molten rocks. Others have thought they were tops of mountains appearing above the great sea of fire. Others still have thought that they were clouds of black smoke floating over the face of the sun. But it is now quite generally agreed among the men of science they are vast openings into the envelope of the sun, allowing us to see down, down, down into the immense abyss. Well, that's also incorrect. But if you look at the, it's just areas of high magnetic field. High magnetic field, different conduct, plasma conductivity, and so less. Now, I think it's got greater energy output. So the energy is released or cooled down there. It's basically cooled because the energy transfer is greater through this electric magnetic field. Okay. Castel Gandolfo, the papal summer palace, lies some 13 miles southeast of Rome, overlooking Lake Albano. One sun-drenched afternoon on late October 2003, I climbed a steep hill to that much stronghold of spiritual residence. The estate extends all the way down to the lake, 136 acres, embracing a working farm, an array of monuments, a garden designed by Barini, an imposing Baroque fountain, and ruins of the Villa Domitians acquired by Clement the VIII at the beginning of the 17th century. The whole site is spectacular. Which is an interesting thing, that the wealth of the church is still amazing. They own just so many buildings in Rome. So my aunt was there as a Dominican nun working on the Vatican computer, and it was just... The untold wealth is amazing. How's the guinea pigs eating? Sorry, my son's coming out to feed the guinea pigs. I was there because the papal residence also houses a fully operational observatory, extensive astronomical library. One of Clement XVI's successors, Gregory the VIII, commissioned a study of the calendar, Gregorian calendar, an initiative that inspired what became three observatories, two just outside Rome, a third within the Vatican itself. In 1891, Leo the VIII moved the Vatican Observatory to the spur of the Seven Hills behind St. Peter's, where for more than four decades the church scientists worked. But eventually the growth of Rome so brightened the night sky that observation became almost impossible. And in 1933, the centre was relocated to Gandolfo. And new telescopes were built, and this astrophysical laboratory laboratory installed. The library burgeoned. The Da Vinci Code avers that there are more than 225,000 books on astronomy housed here. Although as a long-time librarian, Juan Casanovas, an SJ, doubts that number. But it is interesting. It's just that in this day of high cost science, where does the money come from for this? Okay, Father Casanovas was the castle entrance to welcome him. An imposing figure over 6 feet tall with a completely white hair, he seemed happy to help a fellow enthusiast. I had written asking if I could see some of his prized volumes, look over the rooftop observatory, and talk to him about sunspots on which he was an authority. We walked together up the narrow staircase. The whole place seemed deserted and full of echoes, the Pope having long since taken his retinue back to Rome. That's the Pope who built it. As we reached the library, Father Casanovas told me that his first editions of Copernicus, Newton, Kepler and Brahe, but he led me to what was an outsized volume bound in a weathered brown leather, Galileo's first personal register, in which he recorded the first sightings of blemishes in the sun. Wow. Gee. I turned the leaves gingerly, taking in his original diagrams evidence that the great daytime star was not, after all, immaculate, a revelation sufficiently dangerous in theological implications that for over 2 years Galileo told no one. Then Fabricius and Harriot, and finally Schneider and Pisan, competitive instincts took over. Father Casanovas moved away, leaving me to my musings at what had been like for those even before Galileo, such as Aristotle's best pupil Theopolis, who saw spots in 325 BC. Why hadn't his eyes been burnt out of his head? Luckily enough, instead of looking at the sun directly, he examined its reflection or gazed at it through some translucent material, as the Chinese observing it through wafers of jade. The sun watchers, isn't that beautiful? The sun watchers of Xi'an and elsewhere evidently had no idea what sunspots were, neither had Galileo, but as he examined these impurities stealing across the solar surface, he at least deduced the sun rotated, and that the very drawings in front of me estimate how fast it did so. Look at that. Drawings, sorry, you can't look at it, can you? Drawings that Galileo published in 1613 in History and Demonstrations Concerning Sunspots and Their Properties. When his 35 sons are made into a flip-through book, most of the spots are easy to track, as the drawings were made close together in time. Isn't that beautiful? I don't know what these drawings are of. And my thoughts interrupted by Father Casanovas, who appeared suddenly at my shoulder to indicate that I should follow him, and he strode off down one of the long corridors so that I had to hurry to keep up. Several turnings later, we arrived at his office, everything in place, files neatly stacked, working papers carefully squared off. A computer was humming, its screen a kaleidoscope of red, orange and yellow. The latest. Isn't that amazing? Yeah, wouldn't it be fantastic to us? I mean, sorry, it would be great to be a priest. You know, just, you know, the world going on and you are hooked into science in this most unscientific method. That's what we really need. images of SOLO, the Solar Heliospheric Observatory, the joint project of NASA, European Space Agency, to photograph the sun. I had never seen the pictures so dramatic. My major thing is that besides this stuff being out of date, it's so totally overwhelmed. A single high-res camera in space would outdo it. Now, this month is a high point for sunspot, Father Casanova explained. Huge storms are coming because of them. He rummaged through a shelf of books and with a grunt of satisfaction handed me a slim volume in English on the history of sunspots. The cover proclaimed the author, J. Casanova's The Specola Vaticanica. That evening, back in my hotel room near Rome's great central station, I settled down to read. Bit by bit, I came to see that the discovery and understanding of sunspots is one of the most exciting stories in science, and also hugely intricate, stretching over continents and centuries. The two earliest reports of sightings occurred in the classic Chinese text, I Ching, the Book of Changes, which dates anywhere back to 5000 to 8000 BC, and Antel of Adu and Ami on the sun, both meaning darkening and obscuration. Over the ages, Chinese and Korean astronomers noted 150 spots, likening them to the eggs and hens, swallows, ravens, birds. Virgil wrote about sun being checkered with spots. In one of his pastorals, Gregory of Tours in the late 6th century described blood-red clouds on the sun. And Einhard, in his Life of Charlemagne, 1807, recounted black-coloured spots that was to be seen for 7 days at a stretch. Can I say one of my favourite books is The History of Charlemagne, written by a pastor in 1952, and he had back then access to the medieval historians, and it's a beautiful read. I might read that to you guys if I can get to it. On the 8th of December, 1128, John of Worcester, a monk who contributed to the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle that detailed English life, including astronomical events from the birth of Christ to the accession of Henry II in 1154, drew the sun markedly by two dark spots, a drawing that modern astronomers believe to be accurate. He lacked a telescope, so for him to detect not only the spots themselves, but their penumbras, outer shadows, imply that these matriculations allowed. So, wow, a spot has an outer shadow. I suppose that means that's with a fuel that cool down at the most, or you get hot gas on top of them. Even so, not even this discovery excited comment. Centuries before, Aristotle had declared that the heavens incorruptible. And the church in due course concurred so, Europe at least. Any such sightings were either ignored or ascribed to transit of Mercury and Venus. The introduction of the telescope would change all of this. In his history, Father Casanovas equates the impact of Galileo's descriptions of sightings as published in the Starry Messenger in 1610 with that of man's first landing on the moon. However, early telescopes were poor quality, so most observers continued to believe sunspots were somehow not actual parts of the sun, and whatever interest Galileo had stirred soon faded away. Cino de Bergerac, a close friend of Galileo's pupils, being one of the few who continued to be fascinated by them, and here's a footnote. Curiously, one possible exception to the lack of interest lay in France, in sunspots and the Sun King. Ellen McCure, a professor of French history, points out that Henry IV was assassinated in the same year Galileo made the first observation, suggesting that both events represent a challenge to the order of hierarchy. Henry's murder renewed questions about his legitimacy. Galileo's discovery brought about the sun into the realm of terrestrial corruption. It became urgent to restore faith in an order grounded in a certain impermanence and transcendence. And that's interesting that you have this really whack view of things. Efforts to achieve this, she writes, resulted in the creation of the Sun King, whose authority and monarchical identity were constructed at least in part to counter the destructive implication of sunspots. Or 200 years on, during the Congress of Vienna, Napoleon was lampooned in the British press, Napoleon and the Spots on the Sun, which suggested that the defeated Boney had been packed off to the sun because he had nowhere else to go, and further that he, being himself a cluster of sunspots, blocked the sunshine from Earth, causing that year's dismal weather. That's an interesting aspect. Just trying to get into it. And I think this is the this is where it doesn't seem like people spout. It's sort of this egotism or whatever it is. The fact that you're beyond question is really the source of misery, I think. It's amazing that belief that you are a god is sentencing you to eternal misery. The next advance came about by accident as telescopes increased the number of generations of amateur astronomers strove to discover the planet and what was believed to orbit the Sun and Mercury. Samuel Heinrich Schwab, a Dresdale pharmacist turned astronomer, knew his best chance of detecting a hypothetical body was during the passage in front of the Sun. He also realised that he might confuse the object with the sunspot. So from the 30th October 1825 on, he meticulously recorded everything he saw in the heaven. And after nearly two decades, he had not found his planet, but he had tripped over something far more important. Okay. It's a hypothetical another planet he was looking for. Quote, from my earlier observations, he wrote in an article that appeared in 1834, it appears that there are certain periodicity in the appearance of sunspots. His accompanying table gave powerful evidence of a cycle, which spots appearing in clusters. Once a circuit was completed, the solar disk might break clear for weeks, but the existence of a cycle itself seemed indisputable. A summary of his observations shows, for example, that the low point in one cycle was 1833, with the fewest clusters, and the highest numbers of days without visible spots. The next low point fell 10 years later. The high points can be seen in 1828 and 37. So I think the Sydney Olympics was a high spot for sunspots, and so we were all concerned that we could get optical fibre, fantastic optical fibres in for the Sydney Olympics. And you can see, wow, it's very clear. I don't quite understand what clusters are and days. Oh, no spots were observed. Well, so I'm going to sneeze here, so it's sort of opposite. At first, Schwab's analysis attracted little attention, but when the Irish astronomer and explorer Edward Sabine, 1788-1883, saw the article, he realised that the cycle Schwab had uncovered correlated with the fluctuations he observed in the Earth's magnetic field. Then the Swiss observer, Rudolf Wolf, came up with a way to compute the average number of spots over a longer period, refining Schwab's estimate to 11.1 years. That's pretty amazing that the spot cycle. So 2011, and the next one probably it's 2022. Over the next 20 years, Wolf put together a census reaching as far back as 1745. He continued to reconstruct the early activity. He realised how few spots had been observed between 1645 and 1715. This hiatus coincided with the coldest part of the so-called Little Ice Age in Europe and North America alike, when the tidal waters like the Thames and even the canals in Venice stood over. But because of the lack of interest in sunspots, it would be over two centuries before anyone made the connection. Oh, this is a beautiful illustration of the sunspot counter. It's a telescope and its little observation. However, it would take the scientific community a while to accept both Schwab's correlation and Wolf's measure of the solar acting. Enter that energetic Prussian, Bacon Alexander von Humboldt. Yeah, he's he was a super energetic person. Von Humboldt, who'd been described as a combination of his measured studiousness of astronomer Carl Sagan and down and dirty enthusiasm of Titanic disaster discoverer Jim Ballard. He was just a thing. I really will have to read up about Humboldt. Humboldt was intrigued by Charles' researchers, having in his youth spent 5 years travelling through South and Central America. Like, he was just the greatest explorer ever. European newspapers reported him dead on 3 separate occasions. Where besides, you know, he was Bear Grylls, I'd say. Where besides studying his plants, animals, rivers, and volcanoes, he had taken magnetic measurements wherever he went, and found that the strength varied wildly. Sunspots seemed the likely cause. His enthusiasm would make the study of the relationship between sunspots and magnetic fields an acceptable scientific activity. So much so now that over 2,000 extraterrestrial magnetic observatories are dispersed over the globe. And in 1851, he included Schwab's updated table in his encyclopedic 5-volume compilation of natural scientists, Cosmos. Cosmos. He's just... he is really a lost treasure, Humboldt. I'm going to have to really read up about him. I love him. It's just... it's what's not... well, I suppose when I do read, I'll find out something horrible about him. I almost don't want to read about him. Schwab was also influenced the Englishman Richard Carrington, 1826 to 75, a gentleman brewer, experienced astronomer who distilled over a decade. He distilled over a decade of research into observation of sunspots on the sun, 1863. On September the 1st, 1859, Carrington had been tracking a group of sunspots from his observatory when all at once he wrote, two patches intensely bright and white broke out. He stared incredulous. The two spots intensified and became kidney-shaped. He dashed outside hoping to find another witness. The flares were just brief, 5 minutes. The result was, as we know, the magnetic currents crisscrossing and short-circuiting one another at 420,000 miles an hour, whatever that means. Less than 17 hours later, the light and X-rays from the flare take only 8 minutes to reach Earth. The heavy particles from each eruption need between 18 and 48 hours. A magnetic storm erupted over the globe. Its auroras stained the skies as far south as Cuba. There was a causal relationship between the flare and the storm. Carrington thought so, but cautioned, one swallow does not make a summer, and never took his hunch further. Isn't that beautiful? Yet, Carrington's flare, writes Stuart Clarke, quote, was a tipping point in astronomy. The sudden demonstration of the sun's ability to disrupt life on Earth catapulted astronomers into a headlong race to understand the nature of the sun. By 1890s, the prevailing wisdom was that sunspots were made up of strong cyclones, which prompted the great American astronomer George Early Hale to examine them for magnetic activity, employing a spectroheliograph, a combination of spectroscope and something similar to a film camera. He took photographs of the sun and showed the huge blotches of hydrogen being swept into the centre of the spot as if caught in a whirlpool. He observed two large flares, each of which was followed by a huge magnetic storm on Earth. 19.5 and 30 hours later, respectively. So you've got two different speeds. You've got fast solar winds and slow solar winds. By 1908, he demonstrated that spots were indeed gigantic cyclones in the solar atmosphere. I don't think we believe that nowadays. Similarly, I suppose it was... It's hard to say. It's what do you like? All plasma rotates. Okay. That built up in the West Indies and ravaged the Gulf Coast. Okay. The first photographs of the sun, daguerreotype, was taken in 1845 by the French physicist Amald, Hippol, Louis Fizeau, oh, I remember, and Leon Foucault. Now, the latter best known for the Foucault pensions, the demonstration of Earth's rotation. I love that. Isn't that fantastic? Okay. Now, it's going to really, really concentrate on this one. Hale's conclusion that the sunspots were intensely magnetic was consistent with the observation that streaks are visible above the sunspots areas during total eclipses, which resemble the field lines of a bar magnet. Looping out for the sun's surface, these streaks speckle it with positive and negative lines of magnetic force, whatever that means. And channel the storms out of eruptions that extend thousands of miles beyond the surface before being dragged back. Now, it's interesting that the solar rays and magnetic field lines and electric field lines have all got the same origin, except there's no such mathematical thing as a magnetic line of force. This is stupid. Hale's reasoning let observers gauge sunspot radiation, which originates in layers deep within the sun. It suggested that spots were and how they affected the climate on Earth. Sunspots could be said to be a bit like snowflakes, in each one is unique, but of similar nature structure. All are roughly circular, averaging from 3,000 to 30,000 kilometers in diameter. Okay, so just to give you an idea, the Earth is 12,000 kilometers. Hale saw one of 130,000 kilometers, 10 times of the Earth's diameter. Well, there you go. Each spot rolling center lies in what's called an umbra shadow, which appears dark only because it contrasts with the more luminous surface around it. But if isolated, it would be as bright as a full moon set against a black sky. An umbra typically has a temperature of 4,300 degrees Kelvin. Okay, so that's 4,000 degrees Celsius. Now, the important is that it's not not heating up as much. It's radiating out more energy. It's cooling faster. Okay, roughly 2,100 degrees cooler than surrounding photosphere. Oh, I don't like that one. I really don't like that one, because it's really 1,100. I think he's got that wrong. Embedded 450 miles deeper. Well, the story is that you have to understand what the photosphere is. It heats up the layer. It cools down and heats up the layer more effectively. If it didn't, yeah, more radiation would go on top of it. The umbra comprising nearly a fifth the area of every spot, each surrounded by a fibrous grey filamentary penumbra, which resembles the petals of a flower, taking up the remaining 80%. It is about three quarters as hot as the photosphere. Which constitutes the surface of the spot. In summary, sunspots appear in three different forms depending on its depth. The photosphere, the penumbra, and at its deepest, the umbra. Okay, this is deeply confused. It is still a mystery why the spot's core should be less hot than either its penumbra or the solar surface. All we know for sure, well, obviously, look, if I set out plates and there's a black plate, alright, I've got a black plate, it will cool the fastest. It radiates out more, so it obviously it's radiating out more light. It's magnetically cooled. It's sort of like the reverse of an induction cooktop. Okay, your induction cooktop. Or your induction cooktop is heating the atmosphere above it. So it's cool because it's transferring its energy through that radiation to its So there's a certain amount of energy coming into the sunspot. Okay, it's right throughout the sun. It's fairly even. But when it hits there, it's more effectively transferring its energy to the chromosphere. Okay. Some years before Hale's researchers, the superintendent of the Royal Observatory at Greenwich, Edward Malter Maunder, who had been making some important discoveries of his own, keen on sunspots since the age of 14, by the time he was 26, he was measuring how large they could get. Over the next 30 years, he embarked on a massive photographic project, accumulating thousands of pictures of 5,000 groups of spots, coming to think romantically of his task as capturing the sun's portrait, and once writing that taking a spectrum of the sunspot was like seeing into its soul, which is, can I say spectrum means ghost, spectre, soul? If you really understood about what spectroscopy was. Oh, this is an interesting picture. Oh, showing the intensity of tree rings. Oh, isn't that beautiful, the solar rings. Now let's see how much more we've got to go and whether I have to drop my daughter off to school. Oh, my 39, my God. Oh. It's under 30. And we've got another 10 pages more on sunspots, and we have read that's 99. We can't have read that many pages. Oh no, not the Sun Throne. So just reading up, I'll be back with you soon. So we started on 220, so read 10 pages. And I'll come back after this, read another 10 pages, but you can see the beautiful picture there, or you can't see it, the beautiful picture of a tree, and it sort of it pulses with the sunspots. It's really rather nice to see it, but one swallow does not a summer make. Starting again soon. Okay, starting up again. It's a page, so I've had a bit of a rest. It's pretty amazing that I can only last, what is it, looking at the last one, I can't see what the last one is, but it's pretty amazing that I can only last half an hour, so after all this time, but hopefully I'm improving. He found that the magnetic flux increased rapidly during the spot's early life, before sinking into a slow decline over a matter of days. His photographs show that when the latitude of the spots was plotted against a series of 11-year cycles, their positions formed a pattern that, with a little imagination, resembled three butterflies travelling west. The spots furthest ahead in the migrations were designated as leader, and the one had one magnetic pole, while the followers showed the opposite polarity. Just as Galileo had demonstrated, all spots cross the solar disk in straight lines. Oh yeah, okay. And hunted in pairs. They would start out close together and move apart as the group travelled, sometimes at distances that were up to 20 degrees of the sun's circumference. These are incredible different distances, but it's magnetic flux. They would start close to and move sometimes distances were up to 20 degrees of the sun's circumference, while always remaining parallel to the equator. At the end of every cycle, the polarity reversed, so the northern hemisphere leaders took on negative polarity, and the southern positive. The cycle would have run through two successive 11-year sequences, 22 years in all, give or take a few months, to complete itself. Surprisingly, at the height of the cycle, when the spots were most numerous in the solar disk, the sun shone with greater intensity than the dots were fewer. Which just says, it's not that the nuclear power is at a sequence that takes roughly a million years or 100,000 years for the energy in the sun to reach the surface. So where the sun shines hotter and stuff, it means its energy has been put into solar radiation. Okay, so the actual temperature varies. It's not the it's like a car's engine is travelling at the same amount of fuel. It's just it's more of it's going into air conditioning and less is going into power on the road, so to speak. Okay. A cycle is part of an overall pattern of solar activity involving not just the movement of spots, but also prominences, flares, showers, solar wind particles, cosmic rays, and energy. Well, I don't think the sun produces cosmic rays, because it wouldn't be a cosmic ray, it would be a solar ray then. Energy photons, a minute but potent portion, which plunge onto the Earth within some 15 minutes of leaving the solar surface. Well, it obviously depends on the actual speed. To put it another way, the sun throws tantrums. The magnetic fields erupting from the interior discharge high-energy cosmic rays. Maunders speculated that sometimes these rays deflect past the Earth, which cools as a result of that. For example, in 1536, Henry VII and his court were able to sail over the Thames all the way to central London through to Greenwich, while the terrible winter of 1709, wine froze in glasses before the Sun King banqueting at his table. Isn't that amazing? The solar intensity, but it's more the radiation affecting the cloud cover. It's something that I understand. The next step forward came in a likely place. Shortly after the First World War, Andrew Douglas, 1876 to 62, an academic at the University of Arizona, pioneered the new science of dendrochronology, the tree seedlings. The successive widths, broad years were good growing, and narrow, bad years, provide a record of climatic variation over a tree's lifetime. He assumed that trees, the longest living organisms on Earth, were the only objects of the plant kingdom that could offer a reliable record, since everything else died into soil, and noted the years of rapid growth were followed by periods of retarded development. Then rapid growth resumed. On average, 10 to 12 rings appeared at any two intervals of development. One morning in 1922, out of the blue, he received a letter from Maunder outlining the theory about the effects of the absence of sunspots between 1645 and 1715, suggesting that you should see this in the tree rings. His curiosity piqued, Douglas began studying plants from old buildings as well as very old trees, which is true. You can pick up a Tudor building and you know the tree from there is, you know, the wood has been preserved, or piece of furniture, or I tell you what, the Huon pines. We have a pine tree in Tasmania, which is very oily, beautiful wood, and it lasts 5,000 years. Okay. For instance, Arizona pines and California redwoods, and sure enough, the rings revealed a pattern of slow growth. The same period, the sunspots vanished from the surface, suffering a cold snap. This was not enough for general acceptance. Okay, now there's an asterisk here. I can't see where it's from. This is a footnote. Gee whiz, I'm looking at the page, scanning records. There's a footnote nonetheless. Let's read the footnote. In 1937, a memorably named scientist H. True Stenson of MIT Harvard came up with new evidence. Rabbit skins, the pelt records of the Hudson Bay Company, showed remarkable variations in the number of fox lynx rabbits taken over a period of 10 to 11 years. Nearly every peak corresponded quite closely with the scarcity of spots. If spots, oh my god, this is a footnote which goes on for pages, have anything to do with rabbit populations, Dr. Stenson continued, the sunspot years have been favourable for tree growth. One might wonder why rabbits appear more numerous near the sunspot maximum and more scarce near maximum. So they're opposite. Perhaps the trap is stimulated by sunspots have been more energetic in depopulating the rabbits during the years of sunspot maximum. Or perchance other animals who are natural foes of the little four-footed creatures thrive best on sunspot maximum. The argument too failed to sway doubters. Okay, wow. Okay, this was not enough for general acceptance. However, Maunder died in 1928, his theories unrecognized. Okay, now there's a footnote for this. In 1787, a certain Dr. Elliot had fired a pistol at a couple walking out on his out walking, and was only acquitted of attempted murder because no bullets were found at the scene. His counsel had pleaded insanity on the grounds that Elliot held the belief that sunlight proceeds from the dense universal aura, which may afford ample light to the inhabitants of the surface of the sun. It may easily be conceived of far most the blissful habitation of the whole solar system. I don't know where that fits into it. This is the second. It's got two footnotes are all over the place. That's just for later on rereading. Mortar had not been alone in his theories about the effect of sunspots or having to endure scepticism with which theories were met. From the time spots were first observed, some people have circulated about how they affect life on Earth, while others have mocked the theme as early as December 1795, when William Herschel delivered the first of what was intended to be a series of lectures on the sun as effects on Earth to the elite members of the Royal Society, in which he said he had uncovered five periods of low sunspot activity during which the price of wheat had been high. In fact, he connected two unusually long spells of drought. Most of his audience laughed at him, so much so that he felt forced to cancel the remaining talks. But then he was also airing a theory that the sun was cool at the centre and inhabited, a belief Herschel's day was enough to have been declared a lunatic. Or perhaps a solitic. Isn't that amazing? Yeah. To describe the happenings on Earth to spots in the sun seemed to be destined to remain the stuff of fiction. And sure enough, in 1892, Mark Twain published a novel, The American Charman, which the idea of solar vanishers controlling the planet was carried to its logical extremes. Sunspot is big business. In the explanatory note, Twain's tongue is firmly in cheek. This is an attempt to pull a book through without weather. It being the first attempt of the kind in fictitious literature, it may prove a failure, but it seems worth the while for the daredevil person to try it, and the author is just the mood. I don't know. By the novel's end, the scheming Colonel Mulberry Sellers comes up with the grandest plan yet of making fortune. He will reorganise the Earth's climates, furnishing them to the order and taking old climates in part of payment. How? By utilising spots on the sun. Control them, you understand, and apply stupendous energy they will to the benefit and purposes of reorganising our climates. It's a footnote in game. And this is only one footnote. Okay. All this recalls an even earlier satire, Samuel Johnson's 1759 philosophical novella, Rosellus. In a chapter, the astronomer discovers the cause of his unease. The savant question tells Armac, the story's narrator, quote, "I possessed for 5 years the regulation of the weather and the distribution of season. The sun listens to my dictates and passes from the tropic to tropic in my direction. The clouds at my call have poured their waters, and the Nile has overflowed at my command." Quickly takes his leave, as he's a bit of a nutcase. Twain, of course, was making fun of the crazy business schemes as much as he was satirising the wayward theories of scientists. But Mondo's conviction that, and it's interesting that we've come from an era of, you know, fake, you know, scientists getting it wrong. Well, wrong and right. Did exist between solar activity and fluctuations in the Earth's magnetic fields. Well, wouldn't that be wild acceptance? It would take a while, however, because other scientists continue to be either uninterested or sceptical. After the Second World War, physicists intensified their monitoring of solar events. Yet, for all their prodding and probing, evidence of the effects of sunspots remained sporadic. As late as the 1960s, a young researcher entertaining any correlation between solar phenomena and patterns in terrestrial climate branded himself as a crank. Then came Eddie. Okay, isn't it interesting that it's just part of the condition that if you're not in the mainstream, you're most probably a crank. John A. Eddie, who died in 2009, was an astronomer based at the University of Colorado, which has a high-altitude observatory where this versatile scientist was able to study Jupiter's atmosphere, the solar corona, and the history of solar physics, even American Indian astronomy. Intrigued by Miranda's theories, which he later likened to deciphering the Dead Sea Scrolls of solar physics, he couldn't understand why they'd been written off. In the early 1970s, he went to the laboratory of tree ring research in Tucson, but he was unable to replicate Douglas's match between tree rings and climatic variations. Undaunted, next he tracked the history of auroras. That's also interesting that they can take ancient seashell fossils, you know, fossilize, and decode the solar cycles from the growth of those. That there was during the era, after all, undaunted, he next tracked the history of auroras, which, after all, owed their life to sunspots, and established how few there were during the era of the Maunder Minimum, that's the scientist. When the sun was magnetically active, he discovered, it grew many spots, whose increase is something active, magnetically chaotic, I would say. Even the outbreak of epidemics and revolutions, it being argued that the French Revolution began in 1879 rather than 4 or 5 years later, because the winter of 1788 was extremely cold. Footnote. The Russian scientist Valery Orlov and American historian William James Sidis have connected revolutions and sunspots. And we also do oil prices and droughts and stuff like that. The American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Paris Commune, the Russian Revolutions of 1905-1970 all fell fairly close to the years of solar activity. Most physicists have take it as given that sunspots can disrupt compasses of various electrical telecommunications. You know, well, it's more solar storms, is it? Yet it took a while for the word to reach beyond the scientific community. In 1953, for instance, during the proceedings of the House Un-American Activities Committee, Roy Cohen was interrogating Raymond Kaplan, a supposed communist sympathizer and chief radio engineer at Voice of America. The VOA, as it was known, had been set up in February 42 to promote favorable views of U.S. abroad, and Cohen tagged it as one of the 78 suspect organization intent on subverting American interests. And he pointed out that some programs were not being broadcast as well as they should be. Disloyal people were responsible. Capital name names. Cohen. The Voice of America towers where radio messages could not get out to countries that we wanted to reach. Kaplan. The transmission towers couldn't reach certain countries. Raising voice. Disloyal people working for interrupting. It's more complicated than that. For example, sunspots. They affect transmissions. It's not merely how sunspots from all after, but derisively sunspots, or perhaps disloyal Americans selling out our country. Within 3 weeks of the hearing, Kaplan threw himself in front of an oncoming truck, dying at the age of 42. Gee. Look, this... There's so many examples of this. This is the McCarthyism. You know, society takes these bad, bad turns. Okay. Colonel's dismissal of sunspots was echoed by an unlikely source. The James Bond books, the first of which appeared in 53, in Moonraker in 55, Ian Fleming introduces a handpicked team of whose only interest was the world of microwaves and sunspots. However, his thinking would evolve. In both Goldfinger 59 and Thunderball 61, he depicts sunspots as seriously interfering with radio messages. Whoa! This is fantastic, man. Long distance radio signals to systems can seriously be compromised by varying sunspot activity. During the preparations for D-Day, precautions were taken to ensure Allied landings did not coincide with shortwave blackout due to an errant solar flare. Daily top-secret reports of the sun state would be filed from the observatory high above the Fermat Pass at Colorado, with strategists thousands of miles away studying carefully before planning an attack. Well, this is similar to the sunspots on the Sydney Olympics. There is now no doubt that sunspots can violently disrupt events on Earth. Following the invention of electric telegraphy, the telephone, telegraph and telephone lines were strung across the world. Using solar storms, some operators almost electrocuted by sunspots induced surges. A magnetic storm, I don't think it's necessarily sunspots that's associated with in a magnetic storm. You can get magic powers, which is huge current flux, current, to get an electric field you need charge, okay, and charge up here, and you can actually get sparks running along telegraph line. At one place, the operator received 7 shocks, reads one account. Another place, the telegraph apparatus was set on fire. The city of Boston, a flame of fire followed the pen of telegraphic instrument. In the 12th of March, 1979, currents streaming up 16 miles above the ground hit Quebec's power grid. In less than 60 seconds, incapacitated half its generating system. The shutdown lasted more than 9 hours, left 7 million people without electricity and cost the province between $3 and $6 billion. Other disruptions, not quite to the scale, took place across North America. As the world becomes more reliant on electronic satellites and similar technologies, we can expect even greater relocations. What they do is they have solar shields, I understand, and satellites can put a shield up when the sun's getting a bit too hot and violent. It can go into dormant if it's not, if it's a backup satellite that puts a coating in front of it. I know this from as the world becomes okay. Especially since the erratic nature of sunspot flares can leave scientists with little than 30 minutes to give warning. And the immense magnetic storm of 89 was only a third as intense as Richard Carrington had witnessed 130 years before, when some 20 billion protons sandblasted every square inch of our planet's atmosphere. Well, that's a reasonable point. 20 billion photons is nothing. So there's in a gram of water, there's, a glass of water, there's several Giotto protons. The next solar maximum is going to be active for 50 or possibly the last 100 years, has been forecast to start somewhere between 2010 and 2012, as it always happens. And this, the sun's got not much place to hide now. It was the time to turn to Eddie and his tree ring evidence. In January 2005, I visited Mark Bailey, Professor of Emeritus, School of Archaeology and Paleontology at Queen's University, Belfast, who specialises in dendritology, chronology. Despite the fact that he has constructed a table of tree rings that goes back 7,000 years, he turned out to display a bracing scepticism and tight humour towards his chosen field. We really don't know what the relationship, and I think this is true, between sunspots and tree rings, he admitted. He pored over various papers in his overflowing office, about the same size as Father Castanova's, but on the opposite end of Titan scale. Eddie supposes that there were no global events before tree ring chronology begins. Then one discovers that there were, and one must be careful. A 22.2-year sunspot cycle doesn't translate into a 2 11-year cycles. At the point, he got up from his chair, dislodging 2 small bits of stone and a stack of student papers to hunt down for a thin magazine, the Tree Ring Bulletin, containing a long article by 2 researchers from the University of Arizona. The authors argue that while it is conceivable that the general trends in sunspot activity might be reflected in tree ring growth, they couldn't find any convincing evidence of a consistent relationship. It came out in 1972, said Braille and Bailey, standing over me as I read. There's nothing better since. Edward produced a groundbreaking essay a full 4 years later without ever mentioning the awkward arguments. Yeah, I think this is true. My host turned back to on his chair. Of course, sunspots do probably affect our climate, but so do other factors. For the moment, he seemed lost in his thought. We don't know the effect of volcanoes have. We have a good we have good returns for past tsunamis, or how often the Earth has been struck from space. But people think I'm a little crazy worrying about all this. Okay, there's a footnote here which I'll have to pick up again. So this is the end of 11-year cycles. He doesn't seem crazy at all. Braille was talking several years before the eruption of this long place in April 2000. But in April 1815, Indonesia's Mount Tambora blew up with even greater force, so much so that a third of it vanished in the rocks and dust, possibly the biggest eruption in recorded history. 10,000 people were killed outright, with the ash sulfuric acid blasting 7 kilometres into the atmosphere. Global temperatures dropped, food prices soared, and there was riots across Europe, famine. Okay, there's also the end of the following wars, famine epidemics. Braille was so depressed that he wrote his poem about the sun being destroyed. I had a dream, which is not all dream. Bright sun was extinguished. The stars had wandered darkling in eternal space, rayless and pathless. The icy earth swung blind and blackening the moonless air. And it is true that this volcanic activity did start off Frankenstein. They're in this very cold Swiss chalet. So reading this footnote. By the end of the 20th century, sunspots had become among economists a shorthand for any extrinsic uncertainty that sets a crisis in motion, an accidental random shock that by altering expectation leads to economic downturn. Roger Gwesner, in his Authority on Sunspots as a Branch of Chaos Theory. The idea of sunspot equilibrium, he writes, has been one of the most important ones. The economic theory in general over the last 20 years has made us reassess the understanding of economic fluctuations from dynamics of economies and the rational expectation hypothesis. Thus, sunspot theory began to, as an insult, has developed into a useful instrument for descriptive economics. And this is true that this is looking at chaos. My father was involved in mapping the pole reversals and seeing if there was any equation that you could get from the data. There was the luck, what different equation coming from. And he basically came up ahead of this, not ahead of time, but saying that it is chaotic. There is some formula there which is non-repeating. Meanwhile, E.A. Wrigley of Cambridge University argued the seminal lecture in November 2002, the England's Industrial Revolution was mainly due to the sun. The Dutch Republic enjoyed a golden age in the 16th and 17th century because, as argued by Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations, it had ideal conditions for economic growth. For Wrigley, England's revolution was not so much economics as physical, chemical and biological. Reliant on photosynthetic products of millions of years of plant growth being frozen in geological stratum. England's boom from the 16th century on tapped into the energy capital locked up with coal deposits of 300 million years before. Okay, well, I don't know. But it is true, interesting that the maths of chaos is used. I don't know what you could use. Yeah, I suppose there must be maths you can use. For all that, it does not help when other scientists propose so many cycles and correlate them with so many events. Besides the 11-year one, the sun is supposed to exhibit a 154 cycles, 22-year cycle, magnetic reversal, found by Hale, and Glasberg cycle of 80 years and 200 years, called by Seuss. Clearly, there are still questions to be answered. In June 2010, a respected journalist, Stuart Clark, writing for both New Scientist and the Washington Post, argued the sun's activity was diminishing and the sun may even be shrinking. Oh dear. There is evidence now available, he reported, that the sun is slowly losing its ability to produce sunspots. By 2015, they could be gone altogether, plunging us into a new Maunder minimum. Perhaps a little ice age. Meanwhile, new branches of research are growing up all the time. That's weird, wacko. Data from SOHO, the Solar Observatory, have recently shown that glass flow affecting magnetic fields near the sun poles may even be responsible for the lack of sunspots. Flares and other storms from 2008 through the first half of 2009, which have extended the usual lull at the end of the 11-year cycle, an extra 15 months, with sunspots virtually disappearing. But as of mid-April 2010, the sun appears to be reawakening, with a huge coronal mass ejection shot out from the surface at about 1.1 million miles per hour, smashing into our atmosphere and setting off dazzling auroras around the Arctic and Antarctica. The most spectacular solar storm hit Earth for 3 years. We are back almost where we began. The sun clearly creates climate, not just how, but just how much does it vary? A vital question, tried as it is to the great debate of global warming. It is true. But it is interesting that there's all these things. Oh, that's the end of the chapter. And I will do it. The next chapter is called The Qualities of Light. For the rest of my life, I will reflect on what light is. Albert Einstein, 1917. Okay, and some beautiful, pictures and stuff. And question chapter 14. I don't know how that goes. 14, this is a massive chapter. I'm just trying to read coming up. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll get back to this chapter here. Qualities of Light 55. It's another 15-pager. But well worth going through. I just have to remember what's here. This is largely to do with sunspots. And it's quite a good overview, quite a good read. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.